I think it's important to reiterate that Israel is not just home to Jews, but to Muslims, to the Jews, to Christians.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall David I.
My guest today is a young, very inspiring activist who I just want to hear everything they have to say. So here I am with Jess Escalante.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I have to say, for people that are listening, I just stopped you mid-sentence because I was like, you can't say this before the camera is rolling. And okay. I want to hear everything you have to say. But before we start, I want to ask the same question I ask all of my guests. Jess, what kind of a Jew are you?
What kind of a Jew? I would say that I am a proud, queer, progressive Jew.
Proud, queer, progressive Jew.
That's right.
Is that a difficult thing to wrap your head around? I'm sure a lot of people listening would be like, what does that mean?
I think to a lot of people, a lot of my identity seems like a contradiction. A lot of my beliefs, right? You know, like, especially over since October 7th, right? We've often heard about how the Democratic Party failed American Jews, that the left has gone completely anti-Semitic. And I'm not going to say that I don't agree with a lot of that, with the perception that the left has indeed gone, you know, in the words of, you know, Bill Maher, you know, batshit crazy. you know, what defines me as a progressive is not the fact that I, you know, I'm a Democrat. In fact, I don't even know if I am at this point. But what defines me as a progressive is tikkun olam. It's the belief that we have to play our role in making the world a better place. So for me, they go together. I'm a progressive because I believe in Jewish values. And to me, they're inseparable. So, you know, that's in a nutshell the kind of Jew that I am.
It's interesting because people that are listening in might not get the full visual of it. You have the one of the biggest Star of David's around your neck. And, you know, we're not used for someone that, like, wears their Jewishness so proudly to also say that they're progressive. So I guess I'll ask two questions that are related. How do Jews react to that when you tell them? And how do non-Jewish progressives react?
It's a very small space that I occupy. It's somebody used the term in one of my videos. They said, we're a small corner. Because, you know, everybody, I think one of the most dangerous things that's happening right now is the fact that everything's, you know, there's all these camps, right, that are trying to tell people, well, if you believe, you know, if you're a progressive, then, you know, you can't be pro-Israel. And if you're pro-Israel, you can't be a progressive. Or if you're, you know, queer, you have to be aligned with the pro-Palestinian movement. And for me, none of that makes sense. It doesn't make any sense because when I came out of the closet, much of my acceptance came from my mother's boyfriend. You know, I was raised Roman Catholic, and she has been with an Iranian Jewish man for the last 25 years. And she just recently underwent her conversion a few months ago. It took her a while.
Your mom?
Yes, my mother, yes. And so for me, when I came out, coming from a Catholic background, obviously that was like very unacceptable. That was not, you know, something you did. You didn't come out. But when I got so much support from, you know, his circle, from the Jewish American Federation, because she called them under, you know, his, you know, he advised her to call them, and she got scolded by, you know, the woman who picked up, and, you know, she told her, this is a normal child, he's perfectly healthy, all you have to do is love him. So I think from that moment on, I just began to feel that I could have a relationship with Hashem and also be proud of my sexuality. So for me, you know, Judaism from the get-go was associated with coming out and being a proud queer person. They, you know, they've never been, I can't separate them. They're enjoined in my life. So you know, I can't conceive of a Judaism in my life that isn't inclusive of queer people, that isn't progressive.
So let's backtrack and see how you got here.
Mm-hmm.
So where were you born?
In El Salvador.
In El Salvador.
Yes.
And how did you end up in the United States?
My mom was a single mom. And, you know, she had to drop out of college because of her pregnancy. So there wasn't prospects for anyone who went to college in El Salvador. Just, you know, unless you were part of like a very specific class. It's just, you know, it's one of those places when I was growing up that even if you went to a good school, there was no guarantee that you would, you know, find work in your area. So for a single woman who's now a single mom who didn't finish her degree, the only option was to come to America. And so, you know, she left my brother and I with our grandparents, you know, for a few years.
And, how old were you?
I was 5. And granted that we would visit her, you know, every once in a while, I didn't know at the time that within about a year or so of her moving to America, she had gotten into a relationship with an Iranian Jewish man. It's very interesting because in some ways I think that there was always sort of a Jewish undertone in a lot of my life that was never quite obvious, perhaps, but was always there.
Did you know any Jews in El Salvador?
Not personally, but my family had always been involved in some kind of way with Jewish circles. Half of my family lived in El Salvador when I was born. And, you know, my grandmother worked for a Jewish pharmacist since a very young age. And then her sister, who was the first person to come to America in our family, worked for French Jews. And then, you know, my mother got into a relationship with an Iranian Jew. And so, you know, but it was never... it was never sort of like, oh, they're Jews. It was just sort of like assumed that, you know, they were, you know, Salvadorian, they were American, they were French. It was not something like other. I think in some ways I may have lived in a bubble compared to other non-Jews who maybe don't have exposure to Jewish circles. But I wouldn't have known that until October 7th.
We'll get to October 7th, but before that, when did you come to the U.S.? How old were you?
I was 9 years old, exactly 20 years ago.
To the day?
Not to today, but around this time of the year.
Wow, 20 years ago.
It was 2005, yeah, 20 years ago. Yeah.
So you were 4 years away from your mother in El Salvador when you came here. What was your life like as a 9-year-old El Salvadorian kid in California?
Mm-hmm. For one, there was a culture shock. Obviously, although, you know, I grew up in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood in California. So, you know, the kids spoke English and Spanish, so it was easy to acclimate. But there was also, I think, a lot of relief because I felt like I was now in a country where I could be, where there was a potential for me to be something other than, you know, a straight, you know, guy who had to marry a woman and live this life that I didn't want to lead. I think that coming to America showed me that I was not going to be forced to live a life that wasn't authentic. And so, you know, even though there was a culture shock, I was very grateful that America was able to provide a more ample perspective of the world. I'll say that.
And so you grew up in California, then you went to college.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Columbia.
Columbia University.
Yeah.
When you enrolled at Columbia, mm-hmm. were you already in the process of converting?
No.
No.
I was 23 when I started at Columbia. I considered conversion at 21. That was the first time I went to a synagogue. And when I went, I remember just feeling like, okay, this is not really a foreign sentiment. I didn't have a sort of feeling of, oh, I don't belong here or this is new. There was, I don't know if it was because we were singing Ladino. Maybe that's why. I don't know if that's part of it.
So just for people that don't know, Ladino mm-hmm. is a sort of Jewish dialect of Spanish, just like Yiddish is a Jewish dialect of German.
Correct, yes. And so the first time I set foot in a synagogue, I remember thinking to myself, okay, it's only a matter of time before I do a conversion. Like, I knew instantly.
Wow.
Just kind of piecing everything together. But for one, I don't know that I was particularly looking forward to a circumcision. And granted that a lot of Reform rabbis, you know, don't necessarily feel that a circumcision is necessary, especially if you are a transgender or, you know, queer person. I was working with a rabbi who told me that she didn't feel that a circumcision was necessary, you know, because of, you know, my gender identification. But I did it because I just felt that it was the right thing for me on a personal level.
Can you explain that to people listening when you say my gender identification?
Mm-hmm, of course. So for me, the way that I understand gender, right, you know, there's biological sex, right, which is, you know, the set of genitalia that we're born with, which, you know, in some ways you could say is pretty much set in stone. You know, it's a physical characteristic. But gender is it's a construct, right? It's not something that is, you know, tangible. So when I say that I am transgender, I'm not saying, oh, I've made a modification to my body. I'm saying that I don't follow traditional roles of masculinity, traditional roles of what is expected to me as someone who has, you know, the body parts that I have. And, you know, even for something like that, Judaism has been incredibly helpful.
How so?
Well, you know, and some people disagree with me on this, but I think that me and others have hit the mark that the Mishnah recognizes up to eight genders, up to eight different genders. I've had people tell me, well, the Mishnah talks about these classifications, but they're not what today we would call transgender, non-binary. And of course, because, you know, you're talking about a tradition that goes back 3,000 or more years. So, of course, they're not going to use words like, you know, non-binary and transgender because these are contemporary terms. But, you know, these sages, rabbis, were able to recognize that there were people at the time who could not fulfill certain mitzvah, certain commandments because of the way that, because of their gender. So they would try to figure out a way to classify them to see how they could go ahead and fulfill as many mitzvah as they could. So for me, it was no surprise knowing that, the Mishnah recognized the diversity of gender, even though today, you know, unfortunately, so much of the LGBTQ plus movement has been politicized as an anti-Jewish, anti-Israel ideology. I would say that, you know, if we allow Islamists to hijack our causes, one of them being, you know, the LGBTQ plus cause, well, then yes, if you could say that, you know, the LGBTQ plus, branch has, you know, embraced, you know, anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism. But as someone who is queer, I cannot give up and hand out, you know, my movement to these radicals, you know. And so if I refuse to associate with the LGBTQ movement because of some, you know, radicals, then I am effectively saying you've won the West. And I refuse to do that.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And so we've explained for many listeners, and I hope people will go and learn more about this, the difference between gender and biological sex. So let's go back to biological sex, because there's some things that, you know, like you said, you were born with certain genitalia.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked you before, so people might say, like, how is he asking this question? And I have asked you if we can talk about this, because I think a lot of people are either, one, interested, mm-hmm. curious, and two, some people might be going through this decision. The decision of undergoing a circumcision
right.
as an adult.
Right.
That's a big decision. What was that decision like?
So I was crazy to get a circumcision, and I couldn't explain why. Because even though, so let's backtrack a bit. I said that the first time I considered a conversion, I was 21, which was the first time that I set foot in a shul. But I was so intimidated by the notion that I was going to have to alter my life in such a way at such a young age. I had just moved to New York. I had only been in New York for a year, and I wanted to try so many things. I wanted to try Buddhism. I wanted to try Hinduism. At one point, I had even set foot in a mosque during an NYU event when back in 2016 when Trump did the so-called Muslim ban. I went with my synagogue to NYU to try to, you know, build bridges with Christian and Muslim communities. So that's why I set foot in a synagogue. So for, in a mosque, in the NYU mosque. And so I'm saying this because I want to travel the world. I wanted to see everything before I committed to, you know, any belief system. But what I didn't know at 21 was that not only was my mother going to eventually do her conversion in her 50s, largely inspired by my own journey with Judaism and her relationship to this man, but also because, you know, if you believe in the esoteric aspect of Judaism, you know that a convert ultimately undergoes a conversion, not so much because they want to, but because they don't have a choice. And so for me, when my mother called me on October 7th and said goodbye, because in that moment, we thought that was the end. You know, it was her first time in Israel, and she's hearing all these explosions and the craziness that's happening, and, you know, the worst massacre on Jews since the Holocaust. So, you know, I'm reading the reports as she's calling me. And you may recall that the first headlines that came out said, Palestinian militants have stormed into Israel. My mother was in Jerusalem at the time.
And she was there to undergo her conversion.
As part of her conversion, yes. She underwent an Orthodox conversion. I'm doing a Reform one. And perhaps someday I'll do an Orthodox. I have that one, you know, I have to sit with that a little longer. I'm mentioning this because in my mind, I'm thinking, she's in Jerusalem. I'm seeing that, you know, the West Bank is right next door, or Judea and Samaria. I'm thinking to myself, okay, it's only a matter of time before they get to her. So I start praying, please, if this is the end, may it be anything but rape or a brutal, painful, slow death. But I wasn't gonna, you know, just let her perish that way. I booked a flight to Israel in an hour somehow. I flew into Germany first, and then from Germany into Tel Aviv. I arrived to Israel on the morning of October 9th, and we spent 5 days there before we could come back to America. And those 5 days, everything clicked. And in that moment was when I realized, okay, I won't do my conversion later on. I always, you know, thought I'm going to do it in my 30s or 40s. In that moment, I knew, okay, like, this is the time. Like, this is the moment. And this is certainly some kind of wake-up call to let me know, okay, whether I like it or not, I don't have a choice. If I have a Jewish soul, I'm going to be put in this particular time and place for a specific reason to do a specific thing. And in that moment, it was just a matter of saying, okay, yeah, like, if this is what you want from me, then so be it. And then it just sort of has taken a life of its own. And here, and I'm sitting here with you today talking about it.
What did you see on those 5 days in Israel?
I saw a collective trauma. I could tell just from the emptiness of the streets that this had been a real blow to the Jewish psyche, to the Israeli psyche. Right, I think it's important to reiterate that Israel is not just home to Jews, but to Muslims, to the Jews, to other, you know,
Christians, yeah,
to Christians, yes, to other minorities in the Middle East. Nobody talks about that, and so it was obvious that there was this collective grief, collective trauma, and yet this unity that wasn't like anything I'd ever witnessed in any other people. I remember that I had decided that I was going to go and donate blood because I wanted to feel that I was doing something for this country that had essentially saved my mother's life. When I came back from Israel, a few days after, so I flew into Israel on October 9th, and we must have flown back to America on like the 15th. And most of my friends, 90% of my circle, were progressives. And, you know, the moment I said to them, I owe my mother's life and to some extent my life to the IDF. And that's something that will remain for generations. And some of them were faster to post Palestinian flags on their Instagram and on their Facebook profiles before asking if we were okay. So for me, I was having the same experience that a lot of Jews were having of this feeling of betrayal, this change of, you know, it was like night to day, seeing people who had said that they were on your side just suddenly abandon you, you know, under the guise of, you know, being anti-Zionists, which, you know, we all know is, you know, just a fancy way of saying anti-Semitism. So for me, Israel was a sort of coming together of so many things. It was the moment where a lot of things began to click for me.
And what happened when you got back here to the U.S.?
So my mother's friend, who was also on a trip with her, another lady who was also undergoing her conversion, said to me an expression that solidified everything that happened that week. When we were in Israel, I rented an Airbnb in Tel Aviv. So I went and got my mother in Jerusalem and her friend, and I, you know, we drove back to Tel Aviv and we stayed there for 5 days because I thought that was safer. And closer to Ben Gurion, right? Very convenient. or if the American ships come, you know, through the coast, then, you know, we'll get right on. So my mother's friend said to me, the universe is shifting right now. She said this to me in Spanish, of course. She said, the universe is shifting right now, mijo. Mexican lady. And that phrase stayed with me because it resonated somehow. I didn't understand it at the time, but when I came back to America, my universe had shifted. So October 7th happened. I flew into Israel to get my mother out of the country. We come back to America, and I'm thinking I'm going to find the same circle of friends, the same circle of colleagues. And it was as though my world had been turned upside down. So that week I spent in Israel, my universe shifted along with the universe of every other Jew and Israeli in the world. And it hasn't been the same since. And I'm still grieving that loss.
What is the shift? Tell me, you don't have to name names, obviously, but what happened?
Well, you know, before October 7th, I would walk into a gay bar, for example, wearing, you know, my Magen David, and I wouldn't think twice about it. Now I walk in and I'm on guard. Because I've had a few instances after October 7th where someone has come up to me and asked me why I'm wearing a Star of David. And sometimes it's gotten very nasty. I mean, I don't insult them, but, you know, you can imagine, you know, two Long Islands and, you know, you know, and it's like, and if you're going to come at me in an aggressive tone, well, I'm going to tell you. And, you know, on one occasion, I had this guy who, you know, engaged in a lovely conversation. He was an activist, for pro-immigrant rights. And I'm also pro-immigrant rights.
I mean, you're an immigrant.
Absolutely. So, you know.
Myself, I'm an immigrant too. A different version, different, obviously, way more privileged, but yeah, of course.
So, when you say way more privileged, do you say that because...
Well, because, you know, having come here from Israel rather than South America, it's... seems easier. Mm-hmm. And I very quickly was treated as like, yeah, you're one of us, even though I don't feel one of, you know, a lot of times.
One of us by who?
By, I would say, non-Jewish white America.
And you you would say, I think that that's because you are white passing to them.
Because I'm white passing, mm-hmm. exactly. Because I'm a light-skinned Jew, mm-hmm. and they see me as a mm-hmm. as white. You know, I'm Jewish, Judeo-Christian.
And I'm so glad that you bring that up, because I think that's one of the things that can't be missing from the conversation when we talk about Israel, is the way that, you know, I always use this metaphor when I talk to people who are not familiar with the history of Jews around the world. I always tell them, when I fly into Israel, I take off my Westerner cap and I put on my Middle Eastern cap. And then when I fly back from Israel to America, I take off my Middle Eastern cap and I put on my American cap. And what I mean by that is that if I'm talking to an American who wants to look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as this sort of like white versus POC conflict, I'll tell them from the get-go, this framework is not relevant to this part of the world. And you cannot look at it that way. And I think that there's a real push from a lot of sectors in America to try to portray this conflict as this sort of like, you know, to make it this sort of like, what should we say, liberation versus colonialism sort of approach. And it has nothing to do with that. And that's one of the things I actually resent the most, because it has shown me that a lot of Americans are actually not interested in listening to what the rest of the world has to say, but rather in imposing their worldview on, you know, whoever it is that, you know, they're learning about. Because it's such a trend, right? You know, it's like, you know, during Vietnam, for example, of course, you know, people, you know, had a right and, you know, went to go protest against the war. Right. I mean, I'm not particular. I don't have a fervent opinion about, you know, Vietnam, but, you know, I could see why Americans, you know, would, you know, strongly be opposed to the war. But in this particular issue, to try to paint it as a sort of like, oh, you know, American colonialism and imperialism in the Middle East. I mean, give me a break. I mean, it's like when you look at the history of ethnic cleansing of Jews in the Middle East, you know, many Americans understand this conflict from an inverted place. And that's actually one of my biggest critiques of the pro-Palestinian movement, is that so much of it is an inversion of Jewish history, of the Holocaust. Literally every single term, ethnic cleansing. I
think it's even more than just history. Everything feels like an inversion. And maybe I'm being highly sensitive here, mm-hmm. but earlier today, you know, as we're recording this, the issue of Mahmoud Khalil, the mm-hmm. head, yeah. the leader of the pro-Hamas movement at Columbia, is about to be deported. One of the other leaders, Leila Saliba, is a student at Columbia, posted about his kidnapping. Now, he was detained, arrested by Department of Homeland Security. You can argue about, you know, legality. You can argue about whether ICE in general, the Immigration and Custom, is, you know, you can argue about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. This is not a kidnapping. The right. word kidnapping applies to the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim people that were kidnapped by right. Hamas. And like when Rashid Atlaib writes, bring him home, knowing that that is an inversion of bring them home, the Kfir and Ariel Bibas, who would never get to go back home again because they were murdered by Hamas. The inversion is just insufferable.
You know, I cannot tell you how much I resent this new wave of Democrats, which in my opinion has largely affected American politics, and in particular the Democratic Party. Talib, Omar, and to some degree, yeah, I would even say AOC. I say to some degree because in my earlier years, I was fond of her. But after October 7th, she completely lost me. And a lot of Jews, actually, a lot of progressive Jews were fond of her pre-October 7th. And I think she knows that. I think she knows she's lost a lot of us, as well as other, you know, Democratic senators. But my issue with the current state of politics in America right now is that, yes, the Democratic Party, you know, has had a lot to do with, you know, with campus anti-Semitism by not taking a stronger stance against it. But that doesn't mean that I have to abandon my values and go to the right. Because, like I said, I am a progressive because of Tikkun Olam, because of my values of repairing the world. is it convenient? Would it be easier for me, more comfortable to go to the right? Probably. But I think that much of the beauty and hardship of being Jewish is that in many ways you're forced to always find the middle ground. You know, you have to find what is our shared humanity, you know, not just with Jews that we agree with ideologically, politically, but also with non-Jews, you know, to try our best to, you know, build societies where we can coexist. And I think that this is ultimately the Jewish superpower, the Israeli superpower. You know, it's the belief that we can coexist. Of course, you know, I mean, Israel pays an incredible price for, you know, upholding those values. But I think that as much as we may support certain candidates who pledge allegiance to the state of Israel, I think we always have to remember that it's not going to be a politician, you know, that's going to save the Jewish people. It's not going to be, you know, a public figure, you know, or whoever, you know, you think it is that's going to save the Jewish people. I don't believe in that. I believe that what will save the Jewish people and what has proven to, you know, to save the Jewish people ultimately is reliance on the Jewish people themselves, and on being united and having an organized effort. And, you know, it breaks my heart when I see American Jews fighting, you know, and really kind of like cutting each other off from their lives because of politics. I think it's a dangerous game. I have one friend who defines herself as an anti-Zionist. She's never been to Israel. She's 69. And, you know, she, you know, sees herself mostly through the lens of I'm an American first, I'm a white woman first, and then I'm a Jew. So I'm not condoning her stance, but I understand that if I cut her off from my life, then I'm making it easier for, you know, the enemies of the Jewish people to go ahead and, you know, recruit someone like her. So, you know, we have nasty disagreements. We've gotten into screaming matches, but I still consider her one of mine, and I'm going to make sure that I do whatever possible to reel her back to the extent that I can. And the reason I believe that I can do something like that is because I have a friend who's also in her 20s, who is the daughter of, you know, well-established DC Democrats, who told me that she was an anti-Zionist up until she lived in Israel. And that the reason she defined herself as an anti-Zionist was because it was her way of rebelling against her family, which is what I suspect a lot of these Jewish kids on campus who are wearing keffiyehs are actually doing. I think for a lot of them, it's their way of giving the middle finger to their parents. But what concerns me is that the grace, so to speak, that they extend to the other side would not be extended back to them by those folks. And I get concerned that you know, they may not be able to bounce back from that. And in some ways, you know, I think many Jewish circles have already decided that those people are not going to be welcomed back in, which I think is unfortunate. But I think that this is what happens when we don't instill a strong sense of Jewish identity in kids, in Jewish kids in diaspora. Because I think it's easy, you know, if you are the only Jew in a space to succumb to peer pressure to give up, you know, this part of your identity, because you may not see it as central. You may see it as only part. So this friend of mine who, you know, defined herself as an anti-Zionist until October 7th, when she happened to be living in Tel Aviv, said to me that for her, living in Israel had been a transformative moment in her life. It had been sort of the moment that she realized, okay, I am not, you know, anything else first. I am a Jew first. And I know that that's something that some American Jews might not like to hear, but I think that for the sake of safety, we have to recognize it. I think that the state of Israel came about because of the, you know, I guess we could say genius, or just, you know, the incredible, you know, ability to foresee into the future by looking at Jewish history that, okay, you know, so long as Jews are a minority around the world, there will always be a need for a Jewish homeland. I mean, the vision that these people must have had to be able to put this, you know, to carry out this plan. And so, you know, when I talked to this friend of mine, I realized, okay, every single Jew in the world at some point in their life, no matter if they're matrilineal, convert, Jewish by blood, you know, whatever, every Jew in the world has to go to Israel at some point. It's I know that there are people who believe that, you know, they can be Jewish without the state of Israel. And I vehemently disagree. I think that, you know, at the very least, it allows you to understand your position in a particular society. I mean, it's a really complex topic, I think, but ultimately...
You know, I have to say, this is not the Jew in me speaking, it's the professor in me speaking. Mm-hmm. If you... You know, speaking to an anti-Zionist Jew, unlikely to be listening, but hopefully some. If you have never been to Israel and you think, I don't need Israel to be a Jew, you're just not testing your assumptions. Go to Israel and then see. If you go to Israel, visit, and then say, I don't need Israel, then now we're in a disagreement, but at least we're disagreeing from an informed position.
Right.
Dismissing something without knowing, really knowing, experiencing it is just ignorant.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the story that you were mentioning. You went on your gay bars and all of a sudden people start noticing your Star of David in a different way.
Right.
And saying different things to you and how you react. So mm-hmm. What do people say and how do you, what's your reaction? What's your rebuttal?
More often than not, it's a certain curiosity to know why a person of color is wearing a Star of David. Because, and this is why I come back to the framework issue. You know, so much of this issue has been painted as like, okay, like these white Jews, you know, and yeah, you know, it's like, you know, and... I think people look at me and think, okay, and not just non-Jews. I think a lot of Jews themselves in America look at me this way. Maybe I shouldn't say a lot of Jews in America, but, you know, some Jews that I've met look at me and kind of wonder, like, why would I, you know, as a queer person of color, you know, be undergoing a conversion, or why would I be, you know, on this side? And for me, that's part of the reason why I had to go to Israel, so that I could also see the diversity of Jewish life across the world. You know, because I met, you know, I sat down with Beta Israel, Ethiopian Jews. I met Mizrahi, you know, to use a non-politically correct term, you know, Arab Jews. I say in quotations because I know some people don't like that term, but, you know, others do. And so for me, I don't associate Jewishness with whiteness. And a lot of people who are not informed on Jewish history do. And so I think that the way that I move now in a lot of spaces, particularly in queer spaces, is, okay, if I'm going to go to a gay bar today, do I have the bandwidth to be a teacher? Because that's ultimately what people are asking for. Because these conversations mm-hmm. usually extend for more than 20 minutes. And I'm usually dealing with someone who... is looking to be educated without saying so. Usually people will come with a set of assumptions about what it means to be Jewish, about what it means to be a Zionist. And, you know, unfortunately, most people lack the ability to be humble and just say, I don't know, or I'm ignorant on this topic. So they'll try and take whatever snippets of information they have or what they may have heard on the news and say, oh, So I noticed that you're wearing a Star of David. I was just curious why that is. And so, you know, I ease into the conversation by trying to get a feel for how familiar they are with Jewish history. And more often than not, I find that they don't know anything. They know maybe 5% of Jewish history. You know, they don't even know where Jews come from. They know that, you know, the Holocaust happened, and but they don't question why it happened. They don't question why Jews were being persecuted in Europe. It doesn't seem to cross their mind that Jews were considered other in Europe. And I find that much of it has to do with the fact that whiteness is a spectrum. It's not something you can define. So let's put it this way, right? You are in America a white passing Jew, right? But if you had been around, in Nazi Germany, and they found out you were Jewish, then suddenly you're not white. Because, up until the mid-20th century, having white skin and blue eyes did not make someone white. And I think that today, a lot of people think that, they see someone, with a white skin and blue eyes or whatever, and they think, oh, that's a white person. But whiteness, when we look at the Irish, for example, and the Italians, you could look at an Irish person today and say, okay, well, they're white. But up until the mid-20th century in America, they were not white. So it's interesting because...
And Germans were used to be called Krauts. German-Americans.
And so I'm saying this because, but that's an American point of view. So, anytime that I engage with someone in a conversation about anti-Semitism, I always remind myself that, that when we're talking about things like whiteness, they may not look at it the same way that I do, they may not be well versed in history of the Aryan ideology that the Nazis held. So,
but Jess, I want to push back something.
Yes.
Because I remember around 2020, the mm-hmm. United States was going through a much needed racial reckoning. Mm-hmm. One of the main things that kept coming up is from people of color. And I completely understand was mm-hmm. it's not our job to educate you. It's your job to educate yourself. Mm-hmm. Don't give us more mental, emotional labor. Mm-hmm. We're going through enough. And now mm-hmm. these non-black individuals, mm-hmm. non-people of color, whatever you want to call, they're coming and tell me, please explain. Like, no, go teach yourself. Mm-hmm. Go Google it. Mm-hmm. Isn't it exhausting? Like, why should you be explaining to someone who doesn't get it? Like, they should go and Google it.
Well, yes, they should go and Google it, by all means. But I think that's what it means to be chosen. I think that a huge part of being chosen is, and when you look at Jewish history, that has been largely one of the things that has defined the Jewish people is the role of teacher. It's the role of mentor. I mean, is it fair? I don't know. I don't know if you'll agree with me on this because I don't know, exactly how,
We don't have to agree.
Religious/spiritual you
well,
are.
I'm not at all, but I, yeah.
Right,
but,
yeah.
But it's important to talk
and
about
And I bring
things.
This up because from my perspective, it's, I love this saying, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's something like, every once in a while you, Hashem could pick, somebody else to be chosen, right? It's like, it'd be nice if every once in a while you could pick, another people to be chosen as well. And I say this because is it our job to educate people on anti-Semitism? If you don't think so, if you agree, but when you look at the history of the Jewish people, that has always been traditionally the role. Is it fair? I don't know. I don't think Hashem gives us much of a choice. Should we kill ourselves over it? Meaning, should we like exhaust ourselves doing it? I don't think so. And that's why I say that when I have these conversations, I try to get a feel for how much these people know, because I realize I'm not going to do it in one sitting. But if I can at least begin to crack, to create some cracks in their narrative, then I've done my job.
Yeah, it's I want to get to the point of chosen for a second mm-hmm. because so much of anti-Semitism comes from a misinterpretation of
right.
what it means to be the chosen people. Now, I have a different perspective from religious Jews because I don't believe in a god. Mm-hmm. But the point of being chosen is not being special, is right. being up to the task.
Right.
When you pick, you know, pick players for a sports team, you're not choosing the best person, the most valuable person. You're just choosing the person that will be most fitting for the job. I see the Jewish people as chosen people, not because someone chose us, it's because we have chosen to take it upon ourselves to do certain things. At the same time, I want to ask a very related question. Mm-hmm. Do you have the same amount of patience and grace when someone is ignorant about gender identity and is asking, how can you be trans? Like, how can you be Jewish? And you're like, okay, let me explain. Mm-hmm. But if someone says, how can you be trans?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a great question. And I do have less patience for that question. And it's funny because I was thinking about this as you were bringing up the question. Perhaps if I had been born Jewish and came from, you know, a Jewish family, I would have less patience because perhaps I would be more exhausted. But the issue with gender goes back all the way to my childhood. And it goes back all the way to my family, to having to, you know, navigate a space that at times was not, you know, safe. You know, I come from a very, you know, strong military, macho, to some degree misogynist background. So, I definitely understand that mentality. I understand the mentality that says there are only men and women. The world is black and white. And you pick one side or the other. But I also know that I survived that upbringing. I survived an upbringing that said, people like you don't exist. And, you know, you have to suppress that. You know, when I hear Jews who come from the Middle East, or Jews who have lived in the Middle East, Jews who have been in diaspora in the Middle East, talk about how they were forced to hide their Judaism and go to a school where they were forced to pledge allegiance to, you know, radical Islam and chant death to Israel, death to America, if they wanted to fit in and survive, it reminds me of my childhood where I had to pretend that my gender was something that had to be loathed and shunned for the sake of survival. So, you know, it's very interesting because I came out at 13 as a queer person, right? But much of doing a conversion to Judaism is kind of like a coming out. There are incredible parallels between being queer and coming out as queer and being Jewish, in my opinion. And, you know, I know that it's not just my view because I've talked to you know, young queer Jews who often, you know, have expressed that they're often unsure what to tell the world first, that they're queer or that they're Jewish. And when I hear something like that, I think to myself, this is the exact reason why we cannot pose the LGBTQ plus movement as opposite, as juxtaposed to the Zionist movement. If anything, they are incredibly entangled. It may be convenient to look at them as separate ideologies, but, you know, I don't think so. I really don't think that you can take... Maybe it's because that's my experience.
No, I think you're right. And I've heard it said by many people. Yuval David was here and he talked about it. You know, I don't understand how many movements, the feminist movement, the LGBTQ movement, the pro-immigration movement, like, have been taken over by sinister, hateful leaders. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to focus on them.
Yes.
I want to focus on how do we create spaces, Zionist feminist movements, LGBTQ plus Zionist movements. Like, yeah. How do we create those movements and have people like you, like myself, mm-hmm. like my wife, in the foreground, mm-hmm. fighting for both causes, which are in fact one cause?
I think we have to really boost up our PR. I think we have to, you know, this is one of the things I love about Judaism, is the fact that there's so much encouragement on education and on always asking questions. So I often look at it as, you know, we are the original nerds. And, you know, like any good old nerd, you know, at times we may not, you know, be necessarily the popular kids, right?
Yeah.
You know, because we have substance and depth. But I was a nerd in high school, and I was also popular. Why? I mean, this is a metaphor I'm going to use right now. Because I knew that I knew how to play the game. I was book smart, but I was also, you know, a cheerleader. I was doing athletics. So, you know, on paper, you know, and in front of the crowds, I was doing, like, oh, you know, all these, like, fabulous things, you know, dancing and doing sports. But at heart, I was also, you know, I was going to the, you know, construction architecture clubs, and I was, you know, starting, you know, LGBTQ clubs and, you know, doing all that, you know. Why? Because that was who I was. But I knew that people weren't going to listen to me. The crowds weren't going to listen unless I could appeal to them in some way. And I don't think it's that. I'm not saying that we're not cool. Okay. But I'm saying that we could, you know, like, I will throw some names here, okay? So I think, for example, when I look at Kosha Dills, I think, okay.
Who was here, by the way. No, if people didn't see his episode or listen to his episode, Kosha Dills was an incredible guest rap, has an incredible story, yeah.
So, like, when I look at Kosha Dills, I'm like, okay, like this is like, you know, like, this is a kid that you want to have in your... in your gang, in your team, you know, this is one of the kids from the cool gang.
If I remember correctly, he even he said, "Right now is big Jew time."
You know, I mean, it's like you look at him and you immediately, like, I think if I was, you know, a non-Jew, and I think to some degree I can speak to that experience, you know, coming from a non-Jewish background, I think I can say, you know, like, you know, as someone who, you know, is not Jewish, you know, now I probably can't say that. But I look at Kosha Dills and I think, okay, it's like, look, it's a cool rapping dude. And he's Jewish. West Side Gravy. And I mean, and we have some amazing fashion designers too. I mean, I cannot tell you how many amazing Zionist fashion designers have hit me up saying, oh, can you wear this? You know, and I have worn it at times, you know. I mean, Juicy Diva, Tess, if you're watching this, yes, I am going to name you, Tess Bernstein. You know, what's this guy that I love his designs, you know, because we have to rep our own.
I completely agree. It's all about making it. I have always, like, you don't become a professor without being a nerd. Of course I'm a nerd.
I mean, look at you. But you have these wonderful tattoos and you have these boots.
I break the mold, but, like, I didn't look like this in high school, right? But I knew, like, I for me, the goal was never to be cool, or mm-hmm. but it's also, I'm never going to be a nerd. I'm going to be me. I was the mm-hmm. weird person. I was doing myself, and it appealed to certain mm-hmm. people.
I mean, I say this to say, you know, it's like, of course, it's like, that's not the end game, to be cool. But I'm saying this should be one of our strategies. We're doing this for a reason. We're not doing this because we want to be cool. I mean, trying to be cool is the uncoolest thing. We're doing this because we're trying to not just, you know, protect ourselves and save ourselves, but also to save the West, right? But I just want to get back briefly to the fashion people, for example, because I have to name them because people have to know who they are, you know. So, you know, like, Can I look into the camera and say this?
Yes, look into this camera and also say where we can find them. So, you know, for Instagram or whatever. Yeah.
I'm just laughing because I've been meaning to do this. So, if you're looking for some really cool Zio merchandise, and they didn't ask me to do this, by the way.
And we're not getting any money from this. I don't know if you are. I'm not.
No, absolutely not. You know, but Tess Bernstein, you should definitely follow her. Juicy Diva. We talked about Kosher Dills, West Side Gravy. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I forgot his name. Woz Art. Fantastic designs. You know, definitely. I might have some of his designs too. You know, I mean, these are people who are creating music videos. They're creating clothing. I mean, if we can, you know, I don't know if I should say this on camera because I feel like I'm giving it away. I'm giving it away. But, you know, these are our designers. These are our, you know, artists.
And I will add one more who was here, I guess, Eitan Chitayat, who has the brand I'm That Jew, which is more of a, you know, it's not a high fashion, but it's more like everyday Jewish in your face, you know, but beautiful.
Athleisure.
Yeah, athleisure. But before we end, I want to ask you if you could get a non-Jewish person, and you went to Columbia, so a young Columbia student, and you've been so calm and poised, but I know there's a little bit of anger there, but whatever it is, and you can tell them just one thing, what would that be?
Being an anti-Zionist does not make you an ally to people of color. And that's what I would say.
And if you could get a Jew or a non-Jew that is right now being transphobe, what would you say to them?
There's someone in your circle of friends or family who's probably trans and you don't even know it yet.
That's strong. That's very strong. And you know what? I love that. And those two things go together, those two comments, because if you're an anti-Zionist on campus spewing hate, or if you're a transphobe spewing hate, or if you're a homophobe, whatever, xenophobe, there's someone in your circle that is being hurt by you, and you may not even know it.
So this is the amazing thing that nobody seems to be talking about right now. The media should be blasting this. If you are on the far left and you have someone who's on the far right, they actually come together at some point. You know, so we have to reject, you know, extremism from any side. And I just wanted to add one more thing to that. I forgot.
we'll get to that. We can edit more and add more stuff. But I want to end with the Here I Am Lightning Round, a series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer. Just whatever comes to mind.
Okay.
Jess Escalante, what is one thing people don't know about you?
One thing people don't know about me is that I love late 80s Europop. Engelbert Humperdinck.
Late 80s?
Europop.
Europop, okay.
Big shoulder pads, Europop, Modern Talking. That's who I really am at my core.
As someone who is addicted to music, you could have not have chosen the worst musical era and type, but I'll let you go. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
I love you for saying that. One thing people don't know about the Jews, that they lived in Ethiopia for 2,500 years. Some of them.
What is your favorite curse?
Verga.
What does that mean?
The crew laughed. Yeah. Verga is a wonderful word in Spanish that can mean anything from a man's private part to fuck.
Verga?
Verga.
Verga. I'm going to try it out, see what happens.
It's so freeing.
When was the last time you cried?
Last night.
What happened?
I couldn't sleep, and I had an anxiety attack when I was thinking about, my conversion is actually scheduled in 2 weeks. I'm going to be doing it with my rabbi in California. And I just, you know, I was having an anxiety attack because I realized, okay, like I'm not walking back from this. I'm not. And just realizing that I'm like fireproof set on it. So I was just like, and just thinking about everything that's happened. So that's why.
Are you going to do a Aliyah LaTorah in New York City as well? Can we come and cheer?
Forgive my ignorance. And so Alilia Toa is
Bima, like, yeah, go and
Yeah, probably. Yes. No, I'm actually, I want to throw a big, you know, event. So
I love that.
I hope you come.
If you could have any Jewish person for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Queen Esther.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's fitting because it's, as we're recording, it's almost Purim. What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Purim.
When do you feel safest?
In Tel Aviv. Well, that's where.
When do you feel least safe? When or where?
On the subway.
What gives you hope?
You. Oh, is that too cheesy?
What else?
What gives me hope? Seeing American Jews who have been silent now starting to proudly and loudly say, I'm a Zionist.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
I want people to donate to Save a Farm. And I'm sure that there's more Instagram pages than just Save a Farm, but Israeli farms, as you may know, are struggling and, you know, we really need to help them. Food is essential, of course. And, you know, I mean, I think that the more self-reliant we are, the better. So just, you know, Save a Farm, you know, let's help Israeli farms.
Jess, where can people find you? On Instagram, on social media. No, don't tell the your address.
Don't ask an artist that because you'll get like some, you know, very poetic answer. Underscore J Escalante. That's JESCALANTE underscore.
All right. From the moment I remember myself, I have always loved people that break molds. I like people that challenge the world. To say, you know, you think it's binary, you think it's three categories, mm-hmm. you think Jews are this way, you think Israelis, and I'm going to show you as a living experience, a living proof that I'm different, and you are just that. You break molds, you force people to reconsider their most basic assumptions. So I'm just very thankful that you could make it.
And I mean, what could be more Zionist than that?
Exactly. And here I am. Jess Escalante.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."